The official story is that New Zealand was uninhabited until 800 years ago. The oral tradition, however, of the Maori tribes, the indigenous Polynesians that live in New Zealand, tell of legendary blonde fairy people living in hobbit-like burrows and red-haired giants that also roamed these islands in ancient times. So, who were these blonde and red-headed populations that are described in these myths, and what happened to them? The well-known Kiwi legends speak of a time when the first canoes arrived, only to find that there were already a race of blonde-haired fairies that lived in the forest and were called Patupari. Now, the Maori respected these little people who were very elusive, rarely seen, but they could hear them giggling and chuckling at night and rowing their small wakas, which are basically like canoes. And their skin color was described as light or pale. Their hair was light. And they were sometimes seen on the slopes of the Misty Mountains, from which they would come down to the sea to fish. This would usually take place in the evening or late at night when it was dark or very misty. And as the legend says, one early morning, one of the Maori were said to have witnessed blonde people fishing, and they were presumably startled and they took off. But they left behind one of their nets, which from then on was used by the Maori themselves, who attributed this method of fishing technology to these blonde fairies. They also learned from them how to make a type of musical instrument, a flute that they carved, and they were considered to be a sort of mystical and magical people, similar to the Fae of European legend. And upon occasion, they would play their flute and lure away or enchant a woman, and she would never be seen from again. There's another legendary race of fair-skinned people from New Zealand with golden hair, and they were agriculturalists that carved out amphitheaters. And these people were said to be tall, had very white skin, and were likely the origin of the famous cultural tattoos that we see.
Fully facial tattoo, which was only for the ones of high rank. People think everyone got tattoos in the old days, they're wrong. 5 to 10% at the most. You had to be something to deserve, especially a facial tattoo. The people that were basically here before we got here, okay? Well known to be, you know, tall, fair-skinned, definitely not little fairies. They're still around. They're all still blonde. Whether people real or not, they were. We've got a family, you know, who descend from them.
There are modern blonde populations in New Zealand called the Waka Blondes, and they're Maori, but have a distinct different lineage than the rest of the Polynesian people.
We've got people in New Zealand who were once described as the Waka Blondes. A lot of them actually have very traceable whakapapa that's much, much older than any of the Polynesian Maori whakapapa. And they know where they came from. I know one individual, an old kuia, a very dignified lady, who claims to come out of Persia. And the area that she's talking about, very close to India. And when we did DNA analysis on this lady, it shows a high incidence of her blood group or her DNA in the Persian area. So she's quite correct. But then the second big block, if you like, of people that share her DNA are found in Peru.
This is very interesting, as it concurs almost exactly with a Maori legend recorded over 100 years ago by ethnologist Elsden Best when he was living amongst the Tuhoi people. The legend tells us that their ancestors in times long passed away, 165 generations or around 3,500 years ago, migrated from a hot country named India. The cause of this exodus was a disastrous war with the dark-skinned folk in which great numbers were slain. This war was recorded in the Indian epic known as the Mahabharata. The legend continues on to describe their voyages, which eventually took them into Polynesia. They crossed the oceans to Tafiti Roa, a long, skinny land believed to be Central America, and then on to Tafiti Nui, a very large land, South America. And from there, they ventured into the scattered isles of the Pacific. This Tuhoi story describes a very different history to the one that asserts that the Polynesians came from Taiwan, and it could even turn Pacific prehistory on its head.
We came from this ancient place outside of Egypt, named ancient Persia. Today it is named Iran or Iran, whichever way you want to say it. But when I told my family, they were proud when I told them that they came from ancient Persia. Some of them said, "Oh, are we Arabs?" Yeah. I said, "Well, actually, we'd be described as being Egyptian more than Arabs."
We couldn't believe our eyes when we first saw Monica's family. Right in front of us was a living representation of the green-eyed, golden-haired people we've been looking for. They're not just fairy folk of the forest, all mythical beings. They are real.
Published in 1885, The Aryan Maori is a book by Edward Tregear, which postulates that some of the Maori people of New Zealand are descendants of ancient Aryans, which he claims is the same ancestral group that gave rise to civilizations of India, Persia, and Europe. He uses linguistic comparisons to argue that the Maori language shares significant similarities with Indo-European languages, suggesting a shared heritage of at least certain words and phrases. Also discussed are similarities in mythology and customs, drawing parallels between Maori traditions and those of Aryan cultures, such as the swastika, and also expands on a narrative where Aryans spread across the world, including places like Peru, which also have blue-eyed artifacts and blonde and red-headed mummies. While modern anthropologists claim the Maori originated in Southeast Asia, it is important to note that the Aryan settlements would have predated the current Maori, which, despite archaeological evidence, most of mainstream academia considers myth.
In the middle of the North Island, just southeast of Lake Taupo, was discovered a pile of large rocks beside an old forestry road. They looked pretty regular, and in 1996, archaeologists, experts and historians were interviewed by the media on location.
It's pre-Māori and it's even pre-Waitaha. So the people who were here before the Māori people as we know them today, the people of Waitaha, the nation of Waitaha. And I brought the elders here. We came at 4 o'clock in the morning and they came from different parts of
the
island.
The Waitaha elders?
Yes. They came here in the early morning and they came to this wall and they said, "We know these people, but they are way before us."
Lots of prodding and pointing and pontificating about the evenness of these blocks, with government-employed experts saying they are a natural formation and the others saying they are man-made.
It's old rock. It's the probably 300,000-year-old ignimbrite, and the pattern of fissures in it is, some of them would have occurred virtually when it was laid down, others have occurred since.
Now, you're pretty sure about this, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I think it's the nature of the ignimbrite rock.
This statement is incorrect. A sample of the stone was tested at an Auckland laboratory, analysis of which confirmed the stone is rhyolite and does not naturally occur on the eastern side of Lake Taupo. Further research, however, found the nearest natural occurrence of rhyolite being 16 kilometres away from the stone structure. It would appear that the stones were cut and carried to the present site in the Kaimanawa Forest.
I don't think it's got any association with humans at all, the site. There's a possibility some blocks of rock that have come off the front of the face have been removed. That's why it's now so vertical, but there's just as good a chance that they're under the ground in front.
20-odd years have passed, and the expanding tree roots have helped by revealing a bit more. We will briefly touch on the so-called regularity of the blocks debate, but focus more on a couple of other aspects since discovered.
Right, well, firstly, we're in the Kaimanua Forest. We're about 26 k's airline from Taupo Township. And we're standing in front of a line of what I call line of blocks, which the discussion is, are they natural or were they put here by human or some kind of interference? And when you start looking at the shape of it, you start thinking to yourself, well, there's got to be a very clever nature at work here, or else this has been worked on. Now, this, of course, this crack here is, you know, from an earthquake or something like that, or the tree above, putting its roots down. But these tell the story, as far as I'm concerned. And we come through to here, and we've luckily got a tree root that's pushing right down here and has dislodged this corner. So this block here, having moved out, has exposed square edges, and with this little spatula, you can feel the square edges there, you can feel the square edges there, and the square edges there. And if we want to be really clever, we can go to the back where there's another layer of blocks there, and that's all square too. I can't indicate it to you, but we'll see it from the other side. So that tells a big story, and that will gradually fall away, and the story will be expanded, I'm sure. So when we were pulling away the greenery, we noticed a consistent bevel, which seemed to run consistently through it. So we made a little bevel square, put that on there, and just to get a rough idea, it's not such a bit cheap, but we'll go down now about another 10, 15 metres and show you another piece of wall, and we'll take the bevel with us. Yes. So we're 30 paces up from the wall towards the east. That's our bevel square that we took off the other wall. And this is a piece we found here, and I venture to say it's the same. So in finding the bevel, we then found we were standing on a piece of rock face, which was so smooth, we couldn't believe our eyes. It was just like it was poured concrete. And I think that speaks for itself. Square-edged, everything.
Suddenly, we realised that the lower block had a neatly cut recess, enabling it to slide in under the block above, hence locking in both blocks. The catastrophic eruption and earthquake of 186 AD could have shifted this lower block. Popping up from a fairly flat terrain is this evenly sloped steep mound. We could feel with our prods all the way up this mound, going through the soft ash, then the scraping through a layer of pumice, at times hitting a tree root, then finally always hitting solid rock.
Probing through an area here, it's obviously going down through the pumice a certain distance, then bang, it hits a perfectly level area where it sends a vibration back up through the rod and makes a kind of a humming sound as we hit something very solid.
And what does the sound of wood, what does wood sound like?
See, it's like a thud thud, but it doesn't have the dink dink. See, and I'm not very deep. See, look at that. Mm. See, that's hitting root. If I just go here, see, hear the difference?
Yep. So, in conclusion, other than the debate on how even the edges are of these stone blocks, there are, of course, the beveled edges, and with the neatly cut recessed in one of the blocks that we saw, it certainly makes one think. We are 99% sure that this is a man-made structure. It was devastated by the Taupo eruption in 186 AD, and even then, it could have been ancient then. With the evenness and depth of hitting stone all the way up this mound, now I'm going to stick my neck out a bit here, but could this be a pyramid, a flat-top pyramid, in the middle of the North Island? In Europe or the British Isles, there would be great excitement and public announcement over the hint of a discovery of something like this. but not New Zealand. The buck must stop with our government in the spirit of openness and transparency to have a closer look at this thing. Probably the most compelling evidence that these pre-Celtic were living in New Zealand around 4,000 to 5,000 years ago is seen in the Bullen Bowls, of which good examples are found near the Bombay Hills in Auckland. These are also abundant in the Irish Neolithic culture and used as either blessing or cursing altars, the forerunner of the Christian baptismal font. The silence by New Zealand authorities on our archaeological past is deafening, none more so than in the Northland Waipua Forest, where in the late 80s, a couple of $1 million was spent of taxpayers' money on an archaeological exploration which discovered evidence of an ancient civilization in a small section of this vast forest. Evidence of temples of worship, irrigation canals, stone houses, hearths and walls has been suppressed by a government order until the year 2063. The big question is, why is this information suppressed? The government must come clean on this, and we as a nation must cooperate to learn more of our past and celebrate these very early mathematicians and surveyors who are the real tangata whenua of New Zealand.
While there is considerable amount of archaeological evidence pointing to ancient civilizations that inhabited the island in remote antiquity, such as the numerous standing stones, which seem to have been used as prehistoric calendrical solar observatories, what's most interesting are the skeletons and human remains found in New Zealand, supporting the myths and legends of pre-Maori inhabitants whose phenotype lives on in some of the Maori as blue or green eyes and blonde and red hair.
This is one of the caves that had all the skeletons of the Turihu Waitaha people stacked in. There's skulls and skeletons all around here. In 1861, Robinson Bone Mill come up from Onehunga and gathered them all up, paid all the workers threepence a sack
to grind up as bone dust fertiliser. And they all shipped out of Te Kopra here, the Arm Constabulary were there, and they counted these skulls in each sack, and they estimated at least 60,000 skeletons were recovered from just this one region. And fortunately, they didn't get them all.
There's a couple of caves with these fellas in. And the Turihu, the coffin's about 5 foot long, made out of New Zealand kauri.
I was very keen to get DNA and everything done on, you know, who were these people, where'd they come from. And I was at a conference some years ago in Rotorua, and there was a forensic pathologist from England. I was talking to him about them. He said, "Oh, I've got a few days after the conference, I'll come up." So he spent 3 days with me. I took him around these various sites and he examined these. There's just one of the many sites. I took him to about 5 different sites.
Small people?
Oh, yeah, about 4 foot 3. And you know, well, you see the skeletons, he examined them all, measured them, and he took an eye tooth to England. And 18 months later, he says, "Noel, those are ancient Celtic people living in Wales 3,500 years ago. This is where they originated from."
This is not the only genetic information that links the fair-skinned Maori to the Celts. Jean Dossé did a study on the redheads of Easter Island and found that their DNA was very close to the Basque and Welsh populations of ancient Europe.
And so all the skeletons that have been found around New Zealand belong to a pre-Maori period, and the Maoris referred to these people as the fairy people. But we know they're not really a mythical fairy people at all, that they were white people that lived here before the Maoris arrived. And in some parts of the country they're referred to as the Turehu, and in other parts they're referred to as the Patapai Rihi, and also other names.
In European folklore, the fae legends, often referred to as fairy tales, are deeply rooted in Celtic cultures, particularly in the British Isles, where they are believed to be a mystical race, often associated with magic. These fae are described as beautiful, otherworldly beings who can be either benevolent or malicious depending on the story and region. But in regards to Celtic cultures, they're mostly regarded as the good people, often connected to sacred locations like fairy mounds or ancient burial sites where people sometimes leave offerings. In Irish mythology, the Tuatha De Danann are often considered to be the fae people, with stories describing their magical powers and connection to the land. Anthropologically speaking, however, the Tuatha De Danann legends were to a large degree based on a royal bloodline who migrated to Ireland from Scythia, which is the steppes of southern Russia or the northern Caucasus, from ancient Aryan tribes associated with the Magi, a word meaning magicians. According to the Book of Invasions, a collection of poems from the 11th century in the Irish language, intended to be a history of Ireland, the island was invaded or settled by six groups of people. The first four groups were wiped out or forced to flee. The fifth group represents Ireland's pagan gods, while the final group represents the Irish people, the Gaels. One of the poems recounts how goddesses from among the Tuatha De Danann took husbands from the Gael when they invaded and colonized Ireland. While the validity of these stories have been disputed for many decades, what is clear now is that DNA does indeed support the linguistic and archaeological evidence that Ireland has shared Aryan ancestry that stretches from Dublin to northern India, where ancient Aryans also rode in on a horse and chariot when Sanskrit came about as a written language and the Vedic culture was introduced to the subcontinent. The Vedas are India's most ancient Hindu scriptures, written in early Sanskrit and containing hymns, philosophy, and rituals of the Aryan priest class of the Vedic religion. Texts like the Rig Veda describe conflicts between the Aryan nobility and aboriginal people of India, referred to as the Dasa or Dasyu, which means slave or servant, but in more recent times has come to imply a devotee to a particular deity. They were the dark-skinned indigenous phallus worshippers who were encountered by the Indo-European-speaking Aryans who entered northern India about 1500 BC. Recent genetic studies have revealed that India's upper caste, the Brahmins, who self-designate themselves as Aryans, can trace about 25% of their ancestry outside of India to Central Asia, which differs from the DNA of the majority of the Dravidian population. It is this same ancient Aryan admixture that can be detected in diverse populations from Iran to Germany and even the ancient Levant, known in antiquity as Canaan or Phoenicia. Genetic studies have also determined that the Canaanites of the Bible are descended from a mixture of an earlier Neolithic agricultural demographic that lived in the Levant that mixed with the blonde, blue-eyed population that migrated from the Caucasus region, or modern-day Iran, introducing the Chalcolithic or Copper Age 6,500 years ago, that gave rise to the Phoenicians. an ancient seafaring civilization which used both the swastika and Seal of Solomon symbols extensively. That can also be found in ancient Persia and India, the locations where the DNA of one of the families of Waka Blondes has been traced back to. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through Patreon or various links available in the description section. Please subscribe and leave me your thoughts below as I read all the comments. Stay safe, and I hope to see you again soon.